Hello, Left Reckoning patrons. Welcome to Postgame 37. Welcome, David.
How's it going, brother?
It's going well. I enjoyed the talk with David Girard. It's a very mixed emotions from the first public show. The just complete, frankly, rage-inducing. I put it, go Rambo to the private message to David, the way it makes me feel, because just in case the NSA is reading my texts, that was the... but, yeah. Anyways, we have some fun stuff. We're going to make fun of Bill Gates. And we've got an Alex Jones thing, which I'm going to react to for the first time.
Classic Jones, vintage Jones.
Although this isn't the first time I've seen Alex Jones looking young and spry like that, so I'm interested to see him comment on it, on his own appearance. That's very interesting to me. But let's not waste any time. Our buddy Bill Gates can't dodge questions. Well, he can kind of dodge questions, but he keeps getting asked them anyway by people who allow him to then dodge them. He's talking to Judy Woodruff, PBS NewsHour. And I just am reminded about the way PBS NewsHour is slap happy when it comes to copyright. So this will be a bit of an adventure.
We'll see.
Whatever. You guys are already paying for this, so we'll give it to you now, and you'll hear it as audio, I guess, at least. No, they won't strike it, but whatever. Anyway, I'll stop whining about that. Here is Judy Woodruff questioning old Billy Gates.
Was reported at that time that you had a number of meetings with Jeffrey Epstein, who, when you met him 10 years ago, he was convicted of soliciting prostitution from minors. What did you know about him when you were meeting with him, as you've said yourself?
Now, Judy does a good job of setting the question up so far, I will say. So when she says, what did you know about him, that comes directly after she says the thing about him already serving time for solicitation of minors, okay? That's the thing, that's the line of inquiry. Now, let's see what Bill Gates responds to with, like, what he knew about him.
In the hopes of raising money.
You know, I had dinners with him. I regret doing that. He had relationships with people he said, you know, would give to global health, which is...
So the problem is the relationships with the people who would give to, say, sex trafficking minors is the one I think Judy and maybe the rest of us are more interested in, that you overlooking. We know the ostensible cover story, Bill, and we even know that you would happily take money from a guy like that, but she wants you on record to say, yeah, I knew he was busted and served time for this already, very lax time. This was also where Acosta in Florida was told, lay off Epstein, he's intelligence, whatever that means. We'll never get to the bottom of that, I guess, maybe. But anyway, we'll continue on with Bill Gates
here. Also, no. I mean, this is one of those moments where, like, we need the body language expert for this one.
Yeah, come on. I mean,
like, this, our man is, our boy Bill is not looking very innocent in this, if you're listening to this at all.
I mean, yeah, it's a great actual pause where we got him with his fingers crossed and fear.
Interest I have, you know, not nearly enough philanthropy goes in that direction. You know, those meetings were a mistake. They didn't result in what he purported, and I cut them off.
Well, they were a mistake. Why? Because they didn't result in you getting cash from a guy who served time for...
That's the weirdest aspect.
Yeah.
I mean, what was Epstein trying to get from you, Bill?
Well, that's a good point. So I'm going to go to this little old article in the New York Times, which I normally wouldn't, site, but this is a paper of record anyway, talk about Bill Gates, and thank you, Melinda Gates, for all the work you're doing to continue this line of questioning behind the scenes. But anyway, the first meeting, I just want to scroll here, sorry. This is buried into this article a little bit. Mr. Epstein and Mr. Gates first met face-to-face on the evening of January 31st, 2011 at Mr. Epstein's townhouse on the Upper East Side. They were joined by Dr. Eva Anderson Dubin, a former Miss Sweden who Mr. Epstein had once dated, and her 15-year-old daughter. Dr. Anderson Dubin's husband, the hedge fund billionaire Glenn Dubin, was a friend and business associate of Mr. Epstein's, and Dubin's declined to comment. The gathering started at 8 and lasted several hours, according to Ms. Arnold, Mr. Gates' spokeswoman. Mr. Epstein subsequently boasted about the meeting in emails to friends and associates. Bill's great, he wrote in one reviewed by the Times. Now that's useful to dwell on the way exactly what David said. What is Epstein getting out of this? What is Epstein getting? Let's say he has trapped basically a minor girl in his like mansion, and he points up to his painting of Bill Clinton and says, "You know that guy in that dress this portrait he has of Bill Clinton in the blue dress." Mm-hmm. I fly around in jets with that guy. So if you want to complain about what I'm doing to you, just look who else does that with me. Now, yeah. I'm not saying like, I don't want to blatantly accuse Bill Clinton, but I will say dishonesty in terms of that. And big, big eyebrow raise in terms of how much all of these guys participated in. We said the thing about the 15-year-old daughter. And I want to, let me zoom out here for a second. Cause that, when she asked him, like, what did you know about Jeffrey Epstein when you had these meetings that you failed to get money on? We're very sorry you didn't raise money from the child predator. I like to think of Bill at, like, Guy Pearce in Memento when the 15-year-old girl comes out. It's like, what do I know? What do I know about this guy? Do you think a billionaire goes in not incredibly briefed? Briefed about the type of person that they are going to try to get money from? So, okay, let's say it's...
Yeah, the adventures of Bill Gates. He's just sort of like popping into rooms, no idea where he's at, who he's talking to. Yeah, it's complete BS. I mean, that's why people like that have staffs.
I'll continue reading from the Times. The gathering started at 8 and lasted several hours, according to Miss Arnold. I already said that. Bill's Gate, he wrote in one, reviewed by the Times. Mr. Gates, in turn, praised Mr. Epstein's charm and intelligence, emailing colleagues the next day. He said, a very attractive Swedish woman and her daughter dropped by, and I ended up staying there quite late. That is one... let's see if I can put it up.
You're going old school.
A very attractive Swedish woman and her daughter dropped by, and I ended up staying there quite late. That is the punctuation. That's the conjunctions he used. That's how he described it. I just want to put that up as he tries to define this another way here.
What he purported, and I cut them off, you know, that goes back a long time ago now. So there's nothing new on that.
It was reported that you continue to meet with him over several years. And that, in other words, a number of meetings. What did you do when you found out about his background?
Well, and, you know, I've said I regretted having those dinners. And
even though I knew about the background, I mean, Rudriff is really letting him off the hook here. Like, as if he was ignorant of it. This motherfucker was not ignorant of who Jeffrey Epstein was. Jeffrey Epstein is a guy who I barely even fucking follow in politics in, like, the 2008 primary. Heard rumors of, you can look back, it's probably the New York Post, where they're saying, Bill Clinton, it might be a little bit of a liability for Hillary running against Obama because he's still going on the Lolita Express. The Lolita Express owned by Jeffrey Epstein. What do you think happens on the Lolita Express? Does anybody, if you're basically familiar with the plot, it's fucking children. So anyway, that was known by me, dumbass, in Moorhead, Minnesota, like in 2008. Okay. Bill Gates fucking knew that 3 years later.
And he's like, he's completely non-apologetic too. Like he's angry that his saying I regret this is, you know, has not like ended any kind of inquiries as to what he knew or what he is doing. And people have noted this. I'm not the first person to note this, but there's more coming in a second. But this is just such a great example, as people have noted on Twitter and elsewhere, of how rare it is for this guy, despite him constantly being in the media, to ever be questioned in any kind of, not even necessarily hostile, but in a kind of, you know, more journalistic style where you're trying to get them to answer the questions that they're not necessarily wanting to be asked in the first place. He completely crumbles.
Yeah, this is amazing. Go a little bit more here.
But having those dinners, and there's nothing, absolutely nothing new on that.
Is there a lesson for you, for anyone else looking at this?
Well, he's dead, so...
Motherfucker. Are
you kidding me?
Makes a joke there?
Wait, put that on again, because that's like, just like it's, I think everybody listening to us understands how insane it is, but like the question that she asks him is there a lesson in any of this? Right. And the easiest thing to say is like, yeah, vet people, right. Or whatever. And he doesn't even actually answer the question really there. He just almost brags about Jeffrey Epstein being dead.
Well, it's like Woodruff, let's read this like maybe charitably, like philanthropically, maybe we should say. Woodruff says, for you or, and then she kind of stumbles in and like Bill's like in his mind, I guess, thinking like, what are you gonna say for Jeffrey Epstein? Which is like a leap to make. And also like, what a fucking petulant child. And also like whatever, like, I don't know if, anyway, we'll play it and then we can speculate a little bit more on later.
For anyone else looking at this?
Well,
you for anyone else looking at this?
Well, he's dead. So, you know, in general, you always have to be careful. And you know, I'm very proud of what we've done in philanthropy, very proud of the work of the foundation. You know, that's what I get up every day and focus on.
Honestly, I'm sorry, we're just going to get one back.
For you, for...
Absolutely nothing new on that.
Is there a lesson for you, for anyone else looking at this?
Well, he's dead, so... you know, in general, you always have to be careful. And, you know,
the lessons for other people, I guess.
Yeah. Consequences.
I mean, look, I fully understand why people would interpret this as a warning. Snitches get stitches. Cause that's what it sounds like to me. Yeah. And then he goes immediately to, I'm proud of my philanthropy. Fuck your philanthropy, bro. Like, Google Rand Corporation Gates Foundation Education. The fucking Rand Foundation was hired by the Gates Foundation to audit their experiments in the education of America's entire all their children, and found it complete failure. Everything they tried, every school district that they tried to do these little valuations of how can we figure out how to incentivize their all failed. And that motherfucker, like, what? I guess, are you proud of that too? Like, is that something you regret and we should just tolerate you? Like, guy who goes to dinners with a child predator, we should just allow you to, for instance, determine maybe, or do it, just fucking experiments on child's education? Or we should allow you to own X amount of farmland in this country? No, fuck that. We get, like, Bill Gates needs to get the fuck out of here. Of course he's not going to, but
I mean, the thing is, like, this is somebody who should be nowhere near education. This is somebody who should be nowhere near healthcare policy. And it just goes to show that extremely unqualified people can be find themselves in positions of extreme power and influence just because they have fucking money. And it's a real travesty, let alone the fact that this guy has connections with some of the nastiest people and most dangerous people that you could imagine.
Yep.
And there's no remorse for it. No remorse at all.
No, he feels put on. He feels like everyone's giving him the short end of the stick about it.
Like, it's unfair to little old Bill.
In other interviews, he said, like, yeah, a lot of other people tried to raise money from him. It's like, yeah, motherfucker, that's why. All you motherfuckers need to go. You're all bad. You're all evil. You're all, like, basically abusing people on an industrial scale, whether it's sexual or whether it's just, like, wasting, like, their labor time and taking them away from their families. Well, you're all abusive fucking freaks.
People around the world to, like, fucking accept whatever insane scheme that he's read about recently as the kind of solution to malaria or education or lack of resources.
Exactly. Yeah. Here's another bit from the Bill Gates emails that regarding his appearance that he regrets now. He didn't regret it immediately after. A good follow-up question for Judy Woodruff and PBS, instead of like bugging us about copyright, would be to say, hey, when did you start regretting it? At what point was like this regret? Because the day after, his lifestyle is very different and kind of intriguing, although it would not work for me. Mr. Gates emailed colleagues in 2011. Bridget Arnold, the spokeswoman for Mr. Gates, said he was, quote, referring only to the unique decor of the Epstein residence, M-dash.
Ridiculous.
And Epstein's habit of spontaneously bringing acquaintances in to meet Mr. Gates.
Yep.
I mean, it's a decoration.
That's covering tracks, bro.
And the decoration was, I mean, I let's read that in code just for all the conspiracy theories. The decoration, what you mean, the painting he has of Bill Clinton that he can point to saying, I know that fucking guy. I've been on planes with him.
And I can embarrass him publicly like this.
I have shit on that motherfucker. Yeah. And
that's what that painting is.
That's exactly what that painting is. That is blackmail, the painting. And so Bill Clinton, and so like, is that the decor you're talking about? That unique decor? And that lifestyle where he brings acquaintances is it the children that he's bringing in to have sex with? It's a very interesting lifestyle. What was that quote? His lifestyle is very different and kind of intriguing. That's the email that he sent after meeting with a guy who served fucking time. He's a psychopath
to find something like that to be intriguing. I'm sorry, just like on a human-to-human level. To know all the shit that he's into, and you know the shit that he's into, the acting like he doesn't, to even it flippantly say something like that. Oh, it's intriguing.
Yeah. Have you seen the movie You Were Never Really Here?
It seems very familiar, but I can't think of it right now.
You need to see it. It stars Joaquin Phoenix. When a teenage girl goes missing, a jaded, brutal enforcer attempts a rescue mission. He uncovers corruption, abuse, power along his way, and will use any means necessary to save the girl. Honestly, dude, it's along these lines. And there's maybe one of the best oh shit moments of any film about halfway through that I've seen that I can remember coming to mind. So I highly recommend that. There's a movie recommendation at the end of our Bill Gates section. Okay. Now let's move on to more sort of nefarious law enforcement now. David, we're going to kick the tires on a little red-brown alliance. I didn't want
to. Yeah, let's go there.
I'm hoping you didn't want to make it. I was hoping to not make you do a spit take there, so I'm glad you didn't. Steven Crowder is joining us, hands clasped, against the FBI.
Wow.
Why the FBI is not your friend? Michaela Maroney testifies on Larry Nassar. Well, I mean, we'll see, because there's some editorial here that maybe seems that maybe it had to go through Dad. So. And that's actually the point. Thank you, David, for cutting the thing. Crowder's for babies. If you think that you're getting a strong civil libertarian argument from Steven Crowder about the FBI, you're actually getting one for babies. And I'm going to be Nathan Fielder about this. And instead, you should, you know, welcome to adult land, where we talk about the FBI in a way that's not groveling and kissing their boots at the same time. Mm-hmm. So, again, strong title, very similar to our coverage of the FBI. And how they handled the Larry Nassar Olympic abuse case, which is just incredibly appalling. And they've said they'll do training better. Okay. Anyway, Steven Crowder is on to some of this. So let's let him roll a little bit here. Why the FBI is not your friend.
Understand, but I want to talk today about the FBI. Just so you know, we're going to get to that. Why the FBI is not really your friend. And I think it's important to delineate between the guys with guns and the guys at desks pushing pencils.
Right. So
who are going to be the heroes, I wonder, in this?
Already, like, we're going to circle back to this because it kind of gives it away right up top, like, what the problem with is. Like, he likes the Cowboys.
Yeah.
The FBI, just so you know, we're going to
get. Wait, could you go back?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if we're going to be able to catch it, but it looks like he's wearing eyeshadow. That freeze frame.
I mean, who knows? We know he's wearing holsters because he's a big, strong boy. He's a big, strong boy who first shot a gun at age 20, which is somebody who basically had done all my killing by the age of 20 with guns. I look down upon that. I think he's a poser. But anyway.
Paid for Dave's live shows. It'll affect some of the ticket holders. Sorry, but I hope you understand. But I want to talk today about the FBI. Just so you know, we're going to get to that. Why the FBI is not really your friend. And I think it's important to delineate between the guys with guns and the guys at desks pushing pencils.
Right.
There's a big difference.
Interesting. Anyway, we'll get back to this.
And that doesn't mean that guys can't do great work for the country pushing pencils. But that's when we're talking about unelected officials. Hey, you know, Millie. This is someone unelected and unaccountable. Yeah. Someone unelected and unaccountable who is undermining your elected president, thus the commander-in-chief of the military. Then we look at the FBI. Most of the people writing this up, they are not elected. They are not accountable to anyone. The gymnastics sexual assault case, which went on for years, and it's just the tip of the iceberg when you look at all of the fake stings. I don't mean false flag operations.
Right.
What I mean is when a lot of the stings that you've heard about, the majority of them carrying them out, insurrections, were the FBI agents inside these groups. But then billions of dollars in damages and dozens of deaths with nothing.
Right.
Self-avowed terror.
He's talking about BLM protests here.
Terrorist organizations who are committing acts of violence. Nothing. And that's because it's a lot easier for the FBI to go and say, look what we got when you stage a plot yourself.
Yeah.
Than it is to go to your superior and say, we really failed to summer riots really got away from us. So,
who better to be in charge of domestic terrorism than the government agency that invaded the wrong country twice?
Yes.
I agree.
And got us all addicted to heroin.
Indeed they
did. Does the FBI, I mean, or I would put other agencies,
it's
maybe
a little all over the place.
Kind of a swing in the miss there, but anyway.
Did.
Well,
I appreciate the effort. Look, shitting on institutions for solving or for starting fake wars.
Endless wars, yeah.
Good. I mean,
look, they're growing.
Probably wouldn't start with the FBI, but whatever.
And there's a positive, right?
Yes. I mean, movie with the anthrax stuff.
No.
And they put crack into the ghettos.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah. This is all CIA, but anyway.
Don't forget FBI. That syphilis. grow up. So, Jim Brewer is making the rounds. Jim.
Okay, so. Now, they do get into later in the show some Muslim plot. The one that's in Florida, Liberty City 7, I believe, the entrapment case.
Yeah.
That was, and Crowder, he's breaking this to his audience, even though it was the basis of a Chris Morris movie that came out like a couple years ago. But also, this is a very common thing. We've talked about this exact dynamic with Chip Gibbons, right? Mm-hmm. That they do use informants and stuff like this to infiltrate these spaces. Now, this distinction between the guys with the guns and the guys with pushing pencils, no, the guys who are infiltrating militias, say, aren't, it's not fucking James Comey. or Millie, or whoever, or I mean, obviously Millie's military, but, or like, you know, what's the other, Mueller, all these guys who you're really trying to, you really pissing on because they're anti-Trump in your mind. The guys who infiltrate this stuff are like guys who are prone to get into that stuff anyway, but also know a cop or something like that.
Yeah.
Look, for instance, at the like Red Fawn Fallis at the Dakota Access Pipeline stuff, speaking of the guys with the guns, Red Fawn Fallis was basically entrapped by a guy who knew a cop. His brother was like a cop, some kind of law enforcement. And he needed a job. And so like, hey, go infiltrate this group for us and ultimately give a weapon and try to escalate things in a unsafe direction. That's the guys with the guns. That's who the FBI is. This distinction, I think it's important to distinguish between the guys with guns and the guys pushing pencils. That is a baby talking to you. That is a baby that wants you to love the FBI, except just like to the extent that they don't agree with
Trump.
Regardless, yeah. And I mean, it's just unbelievable. Like, like I said, it's guys who, life could go two ways. Like, maybe they're like a returning vet and they're like, I could join this militia or I could join law enforcement, and I get involved with these militia guys. I'm going to text some of these guys too, because I want to cover my fucking bases a little bit. That's the guys with the guns. That's who the FBI basically uses. And we talk about coercion. Like, it's often people who are in desperate positions who are made into these informants and infiltrators. So I'm glad Crowder is joining us in this criticize the FBI world, but I'd say lose the distinction a little bit. Let's let it all hang out there, Stephen.
Well, you deal with these guys a little bit more than I do, but I do think it's extremely on brand to maybe get your finger close to the pulse, right? Say like, oh, there's some bad folks in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and those bad folks are the little sissies who push pencils all day and do paperwork. They're men. the real men, those are the good guys.
Yeah.
And then go on, as you noted earlier, to basically lambast the folks who are the guys with the guns who are out there doing all of these horrible things across the country throughout our history. Amazing. I mean, it's just like, honestly, kudos to him for just staying on brand. Even when the world and the facts are lining up very clearly for him in one direction, to get really close and then sprint as fast as he can in the other direction.
Yeah, I'm going to play a little bit more because he's still on. This is an important distinction he wants to draw. This wasn't just an accident. Here he is with the Jordan Peterson a week later, the JP man.
Oh, little Jordan.
Little Jordan's back.
The people on this show, we're not really serving our audience, but perfect example might be last week. You know, the FBI, they were having to deal with the sex scandal of the Olympic gymnasts and not reporting this for 17 months and 40 more women having come forward being raped, you know. And I use that to segue into something that I've wanted to talk about regarding the difference between field agents and corruption in our intelligence agencies for a long time. But there just wasn't really an in. And how are you going to get people to go long?
So, like, he's crowbarring it to fit this distinction he wants to make between the guys with guns and the guys pushing pencils. But his entire thing is, like, the Whitmer stuff is all infiltrators, which, I mean, I think that's still up in the air a little bit. I think that's something we need to keep our eye on, and I think it definitely is informants there. But also, you know, we'll monitor that, because that is also what the defense attorneys are saying. But, yeah, like, this idea... this idea that those guys aren't the pencil pushers I just imagine James Comey trying to go undercover at some Michigan militia, be like, I don't know, what is he wearing, like flannel, he's in a 6'8" goofy ass, and he's like, you know, we should kidnap her, actually. Yeah. Sure, let's make distinctions about which is the good FBI and which is the bad FBI. They're not your friend, Stephen. None of the FBI are your friend.
Figs all of them.
Now, the real fun. We haven't done a whole lot of Dave Rubin lately, actually.
That's true.
He did take, I think it's because he took his August sort of autumnal recess.
Sabbatical.
Yeah, to clear his head a little bit.
He was deep, just recovering from all these high-level ideas.
His recovery mode August. But he's back now.
He's going hardcore about Larry Elder, man.
Oh, that's true, yeah. That's true.
He's freaking out, the good old Democrat liberal who's now spending all this time advocating for Larry Elder, of all people.
Yeah, basically just a Republican operative at this point. But now Dave Rubin, ladies and gentlemen, is a guy who pays a mortgage on a luxury house by talking about how much he wants to move all the time. And he's back doing that again on this video here, which is, I think this was actually a Larry Elder video. But anyway, here he is. He talks about competition kicking in. We got to play it.
Time soon. So if you're, I met a lot of people last night and a lot of community members that I know that I've met before, and everyone had that.
This is because Larry Elder lost, by the way. Everyone commiserating. I remember when Hillary lost to Trump in the Lacrimose thing. Thinking of that, but for like Larry Elder fans, is very funny to me.
Look, that look of just like, all right, maybe it's up. Maybe it's up now. Everyone said it. I've got, all my friends are leaving. We know California had its first net loss of population. So it's like, maybe we should just leave, right? And it's like, if I left, I know a bunch of other people would be coming with me, and I pay a hell of a lot of in taxes. Quite a disturbing amount, actually, to fund the pet projects of these maniacs, for projects that don't do anything, that projects that just make everything worse. If the high taxes worked, then why is there all the homelessness? If the high taxes worked, then why do the roads all suck? If the high taxes worked, then why don't more people have jobs, and then house prices maybe would drop because more people would afford houses, and then competition would kick in. But none of it worked.
Oh, right. That's fucking funny economics right there.
Yeah.
Can we pause on that for a second?
Yeah, of course.
Can you just do that with the housing thing one more time? Because we got to debunk that as it goes.
Great. Okay, here we go again.
Taxes worked, then why is there all the homelessness? If the high taxes worked, then why do the roads all suck? If the high taxes worked, then why don't more people have jobs and then house prices maybe would drop because more people would afford houses, and then competition would kick in. But none of it works. So it's like,
so we gotta, because this is just like, I mean, I'm sure most people listening to that understand how absurd that is. But let's, we got a good freeze frame there too. I mean, let's just take that at, you know, him at his word there, and just sort of like, let's be very clear about why that's absolutely bonkers, right? Tax stuff we can litigate in a little bit. I'm not like too worked up, you know. I'm not like a liberal in the sense that like I need to feel the need to like talk about why taxing middle class and work class people is good. But mm-hmm. I will note that when it comes down to it, people in Texas, working class people in Texas, actually do pay more in taxes than folks in California. It's only the super wealthy here that get lower tax bills. But anyways, the housing thing is wild to me. Because, I mean, it first starts out with the completely debunked theory that if you were to lower the taxes, then the tax savings would trickle down to working class people.
Right.
Absolutely nuts. But the second part is the funny bit for me, because he's implying there that the reason that housing prices are so high is because like there's not enough demand, right? You know, like as if it's like people who aren't like wanting to buy houses. Well, no, it's because they lack the income to buy the houses, right? And that's different from why the housing prices are high, right? But the fact they're here is that like there's no lack of demand for housing, right? The housing prices are high. And why are they high? Again, it's not because people lack the demand and working people, you know, don't want to buy houses. It's because rich assholes, the kind of people who love your kind of classical liberal economics.
Who would hate to lose you as a California voter.
Who would hate, yeah, very much so. They buy up housing and they use it as a speculative asset. This is, to use Marxist terms, this is the difference between use value and exchange value. The use value is their homes, and there are enough homes for people in this country, but there are people don't get to have those homes. Why? Because we privilege in this society the exchange value of homes over that. And what happens when you divorce these two needs, or not needs, one of them is a need and one of them is like a desire of the rich, right? When you have these two things, they've gone completely out of whack. And you have people who buy houses and they just sit on them. Zillow buys a shitload of houses across the country right now to sit on them and wait for the market, you know, to go up $50,000 on the house, and then they sell it and they can flip an entire neighborhood and make a clean $2 million profit. That's not socially valuable, right, to anybody. And that has very little, and the reason they're able to do that is because there's a lot of demand for housing across the board, right? The problem is not a lack of demand on working class people's side. Certainly income would help folks out, but it wouldn't lower the housing prices at all, because housing prices are high because we allow massive corporations to speculate on them. And we allow people to own 5, 6, 7 properties that they're just sitting on. And then we create financial products that allow people to make money on empty homes, right? I mean, that's the other thing that people don't talk about enough with these things. Like, you can have a home that's empty and it's worth so much. You can borrow off of it. You can do all sorts of things. You can generate money off of it, even if you're not renting it, right? That's capitalism, Bubba. That's capitalism, Dave Rubin. That has nothing to do with taxes functionally. Right? I don't know. It's just like one of the most absurd things to just throw in there. And I think it's just worth sort of highlighting, because he gets away with it because he says a lot of equally absurd and hilarious shit in that little monologue.
Let's just take a little bit more.
Yeah.
But none of it maybe would drop because more people would afford houses and then competition.
I mean, like, what is a like homeless population except like like the most profound indicator that housing demand is not being met? And
but beyond that, like, I'm sorry, like, this is just like, just be like a, you know, a cruel capitalist. What he's saying right there is like people having higher income, and then because more people are wanting houses, the people who own the houses are going to sell them for less. Do you know what I mean? Like, does that make any sense to you? So yeah, exactly. There's a lot of buyers right now. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to lower the price on my thing.
Everyone has a lot of money. I'm going to take less of it from them.
The capitalism understander, Dave Rubin, has spoken, right? When there's a lot of demand for something, the price goes down.
Because of competition kicks in.
Come on. This is high school econ shit. Like, this is your stuff. Like, your entire worldview is like a 17-year-old. Like, this is the kind of thing you got to be on top of if you're going to build a career out of this shit.
Honestly, Dave, like, you know, you're lucky Thomas Sowell doesn't watch your fucking show, because he would honestly be so embarrassed by just that big, because that's like, you know how they're always like, you should read Econ 100. It's like,
yeah,
okay, I understand why you don't want us to read Econ 100, because things like externalities aren't in Econ 100. They're in like 102, right? But this is Econ 100, and you're still getting it wrong on an insane level.
Then why is there all the homelessness? If the high taxes worked, then why do the roads all suck? If the high taxes worked, then why don't more people have jobs? And then house prices maybe would drop because more people would afford houses, and then competition would kick in. But none of it works. So it's like,
sorry, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but when is the competition kicking in? Because that's even funnier, right?
It's like, what does that mean? Yeah.
That's just like a catchphrase at that point, because like, yeah, I don't know. Like, in the weird Dave Rubin world where all the house prices are going in, what is the competition kicking in on the other side of that? You know, is that like a beneficial thing, right? Okay, so we're in a scenario where housing prices have gone down a little bit, but then competition kicks in. What is that going to do to the housing prices, right? Is it going to make them better or worse?
Well, I guess I might get to talk about moving to Texas for another
three. Yeah, it's the tech. I mean, I'll tell you one thing. One, working class people here, unfortunately, pay more in taxes than people in California. Still less than just, you know, I don't know, states that can sometimes feel ludicrous on their tax burden on working people like in New York. But, you know, you're paying less in taxes if you're a working class person in California when all is said and done than you are in Texas. It's only the super rich that it's beneficial for. And take a nice road through the hill country, which is some of the most beautiful part of the state. I love it very much. The roads are horrible. Like, we're paying, like, what he's trying to say there is like the, you know, the death knell. And not, don't people get me wrong, I'm not sitting here right now defending
California
by any stretch of the imagination, but this kind of like bizarre way that people like Dave Rubin and all these folks talk about Texas, as if it's like created this kind of like magic bullet solution to all of these problems, is insane. Roads here are in horrible shape. That's because there's very, very little income. It's a state government that has the philosophy to do as little as possible for people. And you know, you have to fight tooth and nail to get things done here. I don't know. It's just wild to include those kind of criticisms of California as like a pitch for moving to Texas.
Right.
If you're coming here thinking that the roads and infrastructure are going to be better, I'm very sorry, friend.
You're saying competition hasn't kicked in yet.
Competition hasn't kicked in the roads yet, as much as they're trying. I mean, they're privatizing a lot of the roads and doing more toll roads. So,
yeah,
those are essentially taxes. You know, when you have to pay tolls,
right? Of course. Oh God, this country's so.
But those are the good taxes, Matt, because those aren't going to the government. That's going to some dumbass who found a way to squat on like socially needed infrastructure.
Right, exactly. Some fucking troll, literally, like
troll on the bridge. Man.
Yeah. Let's before we move to some Discord questions. I want to see this Alex Jones clip you sent me.
It's okay. Yeah, this is good. I mean, a very quick clip. I just for folks. You know, everyone knows I have a soft spot for Alex Jones. Obviously, he's a pig, and the things that he actually says and does are really terrible. But, you know, hometown product. I remember I watched Alex Jones when I was a kid stumbling across him on a public access television here in Austin. You know, so I've been following his career for a very, very long time. And it's interesting to – people have been sharing this on Twitter – what this first bit is taken from, these older clips of Alex Jones when he was just sort of wandering around harassing city council members over, honestly, I don't know the ins and outs of the conflict, so I don't want to paint in one way or the other, but basically complaining about the state of a city council member's lawn in this video. But anyways, obviously the takeaway is, wow, Alex Jones, when he was younger, did not look so horrible.
Yeah, he could get it, I guess.
And Alex Jones's response to this, I think, is so fucking good. And it's an ethos that I live by as well.
I look like a war-hardened goblin. Damn right I do, and proud of it, because I'm not trying to win pretty boy contest around here. I'm here to take on the pain and take on the attacks and...
That's it. I'm sure there's more, but I'm not going to dig through InfoWars to find
it. It's so funny. He got...
That's why he's so good, man. That's why Michael always got a kick out of Alex Jones, because he knew how to just like handle something like that and just take it in some insane direction.
I don't know if you saw there's a trouble in the IDW sphere between Sam Harris and Brett Weinstein. Harris called out Joe Rogan for having Brett Weinstein on to be anti-vax, basically, and in the process compared Brett to Alex Jones.
Oh shit!
So Alex gets on, and I think he's like, I haven't watched the full clip, but he's like bashing both of them. He's like, these people, they both talk in this soothing voice, trying to sound all smart. It's like, and really, what Sam Harris is saying, we want to bet you because we're liars. It's like it's. He's still doing it. He hasn't missed a really a beat at all.
I know. I mean, yeah. I mean, we used to be able to watch so many good Alex Jones videos.
No, the greatest one of all time is that one where he had that. I don't know if we did it on TMBS, but maybe it wasn't TMBS. But he was sitting down with the guy drinking beer, and the guy came up next to him.
Oh, that was so awesome! That was down the road.
Yeah. Oh right, yes, that was in Austin.
Yeah, I mean, that was down the road from where I live now. I know the bar. Yeah, and this guy, like, for people who haven't seen it,
we might need to do a post
game, so you and I won't even have access to that anymore. That's sort of sad to think about. Yeah, it was a post game a while ago, and like on TMBS.
We'll need to revisit that. I think
Alex Jones, like, somebody comes and finds him.
He tries to sell him
stuff, and Alex is like, thank you so much, son, but I really gotta go. Let me pay for your beer, and I'll get right out of here.
Yeah, the guy comes up with a full fucking beer next to Alex. He's like, "Hey, I'm a big fan of yours, and I want to like start some sort of like music streaming service for InfoWars." And I was like, "Yeah, I'll put you in touch with somebody. I'm gonna see you later."
I also think Alex might be with Milo in that, but I'm 100%. Yeah,
that is. You're right. That was some good shit right there.
That was prime time Alex Jones. I mean, I've said it before in this show. Like, Alex Jones, like, just here in Austin is such a fascinating character. Because, you know, Richard Linklater has, like, had to, like, publicly distance himself and apologize. Do you know Richard Linklater? He's the director.
Yeah.
Dazed and Confused, right? You know, he's a great director. But, like, he did some stuff with Alex Jones, like, in the Bush years. and he's had to, like, publicly, like, oh, we all thought he was a joke. Which I think is just so... unfortunate, because it's like, look, the Bush years were rough, and Alex Jones was somebody who was saying that Bush was full of shit and was bad and dangerous too, and the Iraq war was, you know, bad. And he was joining in all the anti-war things. Again, this is not like a defense of Alex Jones, but it's like, come on, that's why you knew him and did stuff with him, because right. You know, we're all sort of swimming in this like anti-establishment water, and then very quickly he sort of revealed the full spectrum of his kind of like neurosis and insanity.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess we don't really have the political climate, I guess, to be neutral. You have to just like condemn it full. But I did feel a little sad when Linklater said that about Alex Jones, that everybody would laugh at. He's like, everyone would humor him when he was around and then laugh at him the second he left the room. It's like,
yeah. Right. Yeah.
You're listening, Richard.
There's that great book by John Ronson, Them, that profiles both Alex Jones and guys like David Icke. And it's interesting because Alex Jones is making the point that David Icke is like a turd in the punch bowl, saying he discredits all conspiracy theorists, which is funny if you know what like certain conspiracy theorists say about Alex Jones.
Yeah.
But yeah,
that's awesome.
Should we go to where should we go from here?
Anyway, you want to do Discord questions? Do you want to do the rapid fire? It's up to you.
Let's do some Discords.
Sounds good.
I've had enough Bitcoin. I'm sure we'll be back in those
for another week, because we'll get to do this again. I'm sure somebody's going to tag us in some insane shit and we'll need to, like, I need to have the right energy for this Bitcoin thing. I'm sorry to keep on pumping it for y'all, but it'll be good.
Yeah. Cool. Let's see here. I think I might, let's see if I can access them tonight. Okay. Ah, fuck, my phone's not, I don't know why it does that. It always just gets stuck at connecting.
Well, let me see if I can get, I got it.
That's it. If anyone knows if I'm, if I have a setting wrong, cause that's been happening for months now.
Well, I got it here. from comrade Irish Liam. I'm amazed when I encounter liberals who enthusiastically mock and debunk the IDW when it comes to Sam Harris. Is Sam Harris really all that different from to the rest of the IDW? I've noticed that most STEM graduates I meet are dismissive of the humanities and believe they know more about subjects like philosophy, history, and politics solely through their self-professed powers of logic and dispassionate reasoning. Have you encountered this much? Yeah. Absolutely. On the last bit. And I think that's is a kind of funny and interesting point about Sam Harris versus the rest of the IDW folk.
Well, yeah, I mean, Sam Harris can't be as Trumpy as the other guys can. Like he said, he has too many STEM people to frankly be as anti-vax Brett Weinstein is. And he's always been a little bit, I mean, the problem is like when he went on record to start to try to launder Charles Murray back into the discourse. Mm-hmm. Like I don't really care if you voted for Trump or not at that point. So I mean, he is as much of a pig. And like, we talk about all the stuff about paranoia about say Afghan refugees and how many of them are going to be terrorists. Sam Harris directly, added to that with his entire output during the Bush and Obama years regarding Islam and terrorism and stuff like that. I'm kind of losing the thread of the question a little bit.
Well, no, the first bit was about Jones. And then the second bit, Jones. I got Alex Jones on the brain. The first bit was about how like STEM graduates are very dismissive of the humanities.
Yeah.
I think that's the kind of interesting thing about Sam Harris is that like, his whole thing is that he has his feet in both sides there, right? He's like, well, I am a philosopher, but like
philosophy,
neuroscience, right?
Right. So, well, which like, he studied neuroscience. Like, I mean, a lot of people studied neuroscience. Like,
No, I mean, it's, I mean, again, it's like Harris is sort of, I don't think is wanting for more attention. Like I think Harris gets an inordinate amount of folks listening to what he has to say for the wisdom and analysis that he provides. But yeah, it is funny. And I mean, at the end of the day, like Harris has extremely reactionary views. But I do think there is a section of like the IDW that like they need to flow into more controversy than Harris does, if that makes sense, because that's what makes them relevant.
I agree with that. Yeah. Yeah. That's why I think Joe Rogan's choosing to go with the ivermectin thing. Cause I've heard Joe Rogan's numbers are not great since going exclusive to.
Yeah. The Spotify, I don't think has been good for him.
Of course not. I mean,
it's not baseball folks.
I'm sorry. If it wasn't good for Howard Stern, it's not going to be good for Joe Rogan.
No. I mean, I'm not listening to shit on Spotify. I mean, other than music. Yeah. Joe Snuffy says, so last night one of my coworkers actually, before we do this, do you know Lawrence Krauss?
Yeah, he's I think yeah.
He was one of the guys in the like the Hitchens, Daniel Dennett.
Skeptics, yeah.
But he I wonder what his deal is.
Well, I don't want to speak too much of this, but I think he got involved in some Me Too stuff.
Oh shit!
The skeptic community did not react well to. He's Epstein related.
Oh fuck!
Krauss, yeah.
Wow.
Former ASU physicist Lawrence Krauss got $250,000 from Jeffrey Epstein.
Damn.
Yeah. I mean, but I do want to circle back to what that humanities point, actually, because that is important. And I mean, this is a simple argument that may be a bit reductive, is that STEM is a good way to get STEM people without humanities is a good way to get people to make gas chambers and concentration camps. I honestly think the people need to stand up for humanities education in a serious way. And I don't think like I think if the state and like Democrats control government for a while, they'll try to expand education, like community college and stuff like that. And I also think we need to give people, we need to have funding so people can also add humanities education to that stuff. So it's not just like Republicans want stuff that specifically makes you good for a certain employer at a given time of your life, right? Like, I think it's super important and super scary that there's such a rolling up of the humanities. And to, for a guy like fucking Brett Weinstein, who was just some fucking flame out teacher at some at a liberal arts school that he frankly like flamed and torched, and now was in going through difficulties because directly because of the attention he did, for him and a guy who never really published anything but is an evolutionary biologist who I would go in term as far as to call a charlatan. I mean, I'm sure he probably did some decent teachings off the book, but for a guy like that to go and criticize other fields, like even history and like even like the worst critical race theory feminism type shit or whatever, right? Like for a guy like that to criticize other fields and say they should be wholesale like uprooted from the university system is really rich, to the point where I think that he's a operative for like Peter Thiel in attacking all this stuff.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know, like there's something that obviously the IDW folks lack of, like, kind of sense of humility into entering into other disciplines.
I would say, yeah.
This is not necessarily a novel analysis, but like it's bad. And science in particular, like I have a lot of great friends who are scientists, and there's nothing knock against the field in general, but there, it's funny that like, for a field that like very much is connected, you know, to the Enlightenment or philosophy in that kind of sense, at least we're connected disciplines for the vast majority of their history. There's a kind of like idea that like that train just sort of stops at some point. And there's not a lot of respect given across the board. I don't know. It's a bit of a shame, but can you, we got some, well, let me read this, Joe, and then we have some new folks. I want to make sure that we're getting people who don't usually ask questions a chance to. Joe Snuffy says, so last night, one of my coworkers suggested we conduct a slowdown as a crew. The company is swapping the shifts of all of the supervisors because that is apparently the only way to determine whether they should blame the supervisors or the crews for costs being up, because, you know, it can't possibly be the fault of management. Anyways, the first ship supervisor for our area is loathed, and he is the subject of some ongoing investigations with HR for harassment and with security for the theft, personal property destruction against people in my crew. Mm-hmm. Jesus. And he is who we are supposedly going to have to work with for a while. Folks are pissed and have suggested we pace ourselves so his numbers are garbage. Not sure if this is a good plan. It doesn't seem like one, but I'm not sure what better idea I can suggest. Well, I can't, you know, tell you necessarily what to do in the situation, but you know, work slowdowns, work stoppages. I mean, that's a pretty classic tactic of people to sort of voice their frustration in a way that hits the pocketbooks of the people at the top. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think it's definitely a viable way to sort of flex your muscles. Obviously, you know, be careful.
Yeah, best of luck, and let us know how that goes, Joe.
Yeah, always appreciate hearing from you, Joe. Louisiana Anarchist says, given that we need to organize people affected by the carceral state, what do you think are the best ways of organizing ex-felons and others? Are there historical examples that can show us the way? Well, on the history part, I mean, the Bolshevik Revolution, they were all ex-convicts. You know, like Leon Trotsky, you know, Leon wasn't his name, nor was Trotsky, but was in fact a prison guard who was extremely cruel and had tortured him and other folks. And when Trotsky escaped from prison, when he got out of prison, he renamed himself with the last name of this cruel prison guard, and they gave him the first name Leon, you know, for lion. So yeah, I mean, you know, damn. It's not Trotsky alone. Like they all those guys were affected by the state, and like for sure, I mean, there's plenty of in the United States tradition, as in other countries' tradition, people who are targeted by the carceral state tend to be quite radical, and they understand the full strength and weight of the repressive apparatus of the state. What are the best ways of organizing ex-felons and others? I mean, I know there are people who try to do that kind of direct work and specifically organize people when they're incarcerated. But I think the best way is to have a kind of a net, a political net, when people are reentering into, you know, societies and communities, having it being the socialists, the ones who are talking about doing something different and changing things and being attractive. I mean, you know, it's a meta answer, but that's the best way. As to like practical things in your communities, I would for sure be trying to reach out and finding ways to be open and, you know, to encourage people like that to join your organizations for sure.
Yeah, there's definitely orgs that I think are probably doing this work, and maybe like even like pen pal things, writing to people in thing and when they're behind bars before they get out. I don't know.
I have a good one. I am the lobster hierarchy. Just some good news here. I just want to say we had our first DSA in-person meeting here in Salt Lake City in a year and a half to go over potential campaigns and do strategic planning. Congratulations. I'm sure that's really nice to be able to see folks again.
SLC.
It was great to actually be active in something political and not just feel passive dread. Get active in some orgs, everyone. 100% agree with that. And congratulations to y'all. Let's get rid of the Yankee menace, Mitt Romney. we got a few. I want to make sure. This is so Edwin wants to ask me something Richard Wolff has talked about with regards to how to differentiate socialism and capitalism from each other. It's how surplus value and profits are distributed rather than the size of state programs or abolishing private property and currency. What are your agreements and or contentions with this type of approach? I'd be curious to sort of read and hear the full context here, but I do think specifically on the question of the size of state programs, I think that that's something that absolutely needs to be eradicated from the way that most people think of socialism. I think the best way to put it is the way that Leo Panish puts it, which is that socialism is a process of democratizing society and most notably democratizing the workplace. It's not like necessarily even like a set of policies or the size of the state. I think that that's something that people get really worked up that could be unhelpful. Yeah. And everyone wants to ask you, Matt, what's your read on Lula's opinion / perspective on socialism and broadly speaking, the left? While I love Lula, I don't get the sense that he was particularly committed to building socialism in the same way that someone like Chavez was later in his life. Is Lula's political project one that communists should take something away from, or is it a distinct entity from other center-left leaders?
I mean, I think it's definitely a distinct entity from other center-left leaders. David can answer the question as to should communists take something from it. But I mean, I think there's we talked with Victor Poggi about Guillaume Bolas and alternatives to the basically Lula model in Brazil. And I think for communists, maybe that where you'd want to direct your attention.
Yeah. I mean, I would echo Matt. And the only other thing I'd add is that Michael mentioned this. I mentioned this in the episode that Lula very much, you know, was early on trying to see if there could be a kind of everybody wins scenario, and has, you know, seeing that that's not the case and is talking a little bit differently now about these kind of things.
I mean, it's a give and take, because it's also like he's campaigning in a smart way that's like basically like a trust science kind of guy, right? So yeah. Like, which is, I think you should give politicians a leeway when they're in campaign mode to talk like that, as long as you can trust that they have commitment to like this broader thing. And I agree with you that that's a good sign that, I mean, Lula's been through this shit, right? Like,
yeah.
And the example that he said, like, it shouldn't be glossed over. Like, while basically nourishing people to more... to like being taller in his country, he also sets this amazing example of what happens when you do that. And yes. Also like basically lower barriers to things like airports, and all of a sudden they say, well, the elites that were used to be in the exclusive sort of like controllers of society are saying, well, you've made the airports seem like bus stops now. Like, that lesson is, in terms of like doing good and also sort of demonstrating the system that we're currently all fighting against, I mean, Lula puts up numbers.
Yeah, 100% agree. Opsa Prime says, any thoughts with the growing public / media anger towards the treatment of the deported Haitian refugees? What I would interpret as a contradiction of lack of anger toward the treatment of Central American, South American migrants during the Biden administration. I think they're both certainly connected in the sense that even the anger right now, a lot of people who you would want to start to turn their attention to the Biden administration aren't really connecting the dots there. But yeah, I think that the larger point you make is true, that like people have tuned out of the border.
Yeah, the reason people are tuned into this Haitian stuff is because Republicans are making an issue.
Republicans are making an issue, and they were striking images that drew people in.
Yeah,
and I think that it's a real kind of moral tragedy for the country, among many other things. And you know, we talk about it a good bit at the top of the show, and you know, hopefully the thing is like, what we can do is try to highlight it, why it's important. JB Funk says, did Griscom just do a pump and dump for his Bitcoin segment? Probably should have. Ket says, hang on a second, Matt, didn't Sam officially turn in his IDW card?
Sam Harris did officially turn in his IDW card over Trump's there were being Trumpers, basically crypto Trumpers, which I mean, look, Sam Harris can hit sometimes.
JB Funk also said, don't underestimate what people know in Moorhead, Minnesota. Kowalski's got some agricultural news that he didn't cover on MR. The Earth Overshoot Day was July 29th. On that day, we reached the threshold of what we can reap from the Earth in a year and expect the plant to replace it. We harvest too many trees, kill too many animals, over irrigate, and catch too many fish. Agriculture plays the biggest role in this, and until we adapt to more sustainable practices, the biological resources of the planet will deplete. Conservatives want to stop overspending, yet unlike the arbitrary construct of currency, we do have a finite amount of biological capital. And they don't care about borrowing the future generation's share of life, leaving them with nothing. He also says a little bit later, happy equinox. May you all have a bountiful fall harvest.
I mean, talk about resource management by capitalists in American over history. Like, Virginia colonies were notable because these fucking cavaliers came over and started forcing slaves, whether native captives or Africans, to farm tobacco for them. Tobacco depleted the nutrients of the land after fucking like seven years mainly. So all of a sudden we have issues with people starving because the land can't grow shit anymore. So you have to keep expanding and expanding and expanding. And yeah, expanded out to where we're at basically today. And the only reason like people like my mom's family, for instance, have like a family dairy farm, in my reading of history, why that fortuitous circumstance and frankly democratic distribution of land happened was basically they were useful as placeholders as we removed Native Americans from that land. And once that stopped becoming useful, then you get, which is basically immediately after you give the land to people, you get rates that basically make it very, very difficult to continue owning that land. And then they get bought up by big corporations, like, which is basically where we have now. I'm sure Kowalski, I'd be curious, Kowalski, actually some commentary on monopoly and centralization. You know, we've talked about Bill Gates buying shit up like that, but yeah, that's that. Our egg policy is pretty bad.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Egan Erkin says Epstein famously was also financial advisor for Musk and arranged Kimball Musk with a lover. This is all well documented. Trunon did some good Eps on it. I was not aware of that.
The Kimball Musk, yeah, I'm not sure exactly what their relationship was, but I do remember something with Kimball Musk, which is just fucking that goofball.
Blake also notes this, this is a comment here, regarding the Fed, reverse repos have been over $1 trillion a day for the past month. Today, they increased over the individual limit from $80 billion to $160 billion. And an hour later, Powell, made a statement saying no one should assume the Fed could fully protect the markets or the economy in the event of a default. And that's the thing. There's a lot of stuff that's basically being held up by these policies that is quite shaky. Egan has two questions to sort of round it out. The last one I'll just sort of cover. I can't do it right now, but Egan was asking if I could at some point do a breakdown of Marx's conception of relative surplus versus absolute surplus value. Marx says capitalized relative surplus value is what enables the capitalist to accumulate wealth without hoarding money by investing into fixed capital assets that serve simultaneously as a means of production of vehicles of accumulation. How production and accumulation vary between relative and absolute would be very helpful. This is such an important concept for Marxian econ. Well, I would love to be able to do that. Also, would love for somebody else to help me work through that for sure. And Egan has a question for us and a suggestion. Have you guys listened to Subliminal Jihad? I recently found them after they went on an episode of Trillbillies. They do deep politics and conspiracy stuff. They have one of the most interesting Epps that makes the case that Epstein was part of a network of so-called gifted kids tapped by intelligence. Walter Breen managed some of these gifted networks. They include many people that went on to be famous scientists, etc.
Well, I don't know, but that might explain like his weird Dalton School thing.
How he became
Bill Barr's dad. His
origin story is very funky.
Yeah, Bill Barr's dad hired him at a private school in Manhattan.
Well, that's it for questions. I really appreciate everybody. I think that was a fun main episode and post game as well. This Sunday, we'll be releasing a conversation with our friend. I'm really excited to have her joining us, Dominique Remy, filmmaker, an incredible resource on many, many different topics. We're going to be talking about abortion, particularly what's going on here in Texas. But also the kind of class and racial analysis as to why there's such an effort to restrict people's rights to healthcare. So look forward to that on Sunday. As always, feel free to reach out to us with any questions, concerns, comments, or even just ideas. We also like the occasional email telling us we're doing a good job too as well. and I really thanks so much, everybody, for letting us do this. We appreciate all of y'all very much and talk to you soon.
Peace.